together a story. There's no doubt Nathan boasted to someone that he was headed to Miami on a private jet, and this will cause the cops to chase their tails for a while. I have no way of knowing if the authorities can link their missing man to Nathaniel Coley, the clown who recently left town with a fake passport, 4 kilos of coke, and a pistol, but I doubt it. He might not be located until someone down in Jamaica finally allows him to make a phone call. Whom he calls and what he tells that person is anyone's guess. He is more likely to count the hours and days until I return with a sack full of cash and start bribing people. After weeks, maybe a month, he'll realize his old pal Reed stiffed him, took the money, and ran. I almost feel sorry for him. At 1 a.m., I approach Asheville, North Carolina, and see a sign for the motel at a busy interchange. Parked behind it, and out of view, is a little blue Honda Accord with my dear Vanessa sitting behind the wheel, the Glock at her side. I park next to her, and we step inside our first floor room. We kiss and embrace, but we are much too tense to get amorous. We quietly unload her trunk and toss the backpacks on one of the beds. I lock the door, chain it, and stick a chair under the doorknob. I pull the curtains tight, then hang towels from the rods to cover the slits and cracks and make certain no one can see inside our little vault. While I do this, Vanessa takes a shower. And when she emerges from the bathroom, she is wearing nothing but a short, terry cloth bathrobe that reveals miles and miles of the prettiest legs I've ever seen. "Don't even think about it," she says. She's exhausted. Maybe tomorrow. We empty the backpacks, put on disposable latex gloves, and make a neat arrangement of 18 cigar boxes, each secured with 2 precise bands of silver duct tape. We notice 2 have apparently been opened, with the tape cut along the top, and we set them aside. Using a small penknife, I cut the tape on the first canister and open the box. We remove the mini bars, count them, 30, then put them back inside and retape the lid. Vanessa scribbles down the quantity, and we open the second one. It has 32 mini bars, all shiny, perfectly sized, and seemingly untouched by human hands. "Beautiful. Just beautiful," she says over and over. "It will last for centuries." "Forever," I say, rubbing a mini bar. "Wouldn't you love to know what part of the world it came from?" She laughs because we'll never know. We open all 16 of the sealed boxes, then inventory the mini bars from the 2 that had previously been opened. They held about half the number as the others. Our total is 570. With gold fluctuating around $1,500 an ounce, our jackpot is worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $8.5 million. We lie on the bed with the gold stacked between us, and it's impossible not to smile. We need a bottle of champagne, but at 2 o'clock on a Monday morning in a cheap motel in North Carolina, champagne does not exist. There is so much to take in here, at this moment, but one of the more glorious aspects of our project is that no one is looking for this treasure. Other than Nathan Cooley, no one knows it exists. We took it from a thief, one who left no trail. Seeing, touching, and counting our fortune has energized us. I yank off her bathrobe, and we crawl under the covers of the other bed. Try as we may, it's difficult to make love without keeping one eye on the gold. When we finish, we collapse with exhaustion and sleep like the dead. Chapter 38. At 6:30 Monday morning, Agent Fox walked into the large office of Victor Westlake and said, "The Jamaicans are as slow as ever. Nothing much to add. Baldwin arrived late Friday night on a jet chartered from a company in Raleigh, a nice plane that is currently being seized by Jamaican customs and can't come home. No sign of Baldwin. His friend Nathaniel Coley tried to enter with a fake passport and is now locked up just like the airplane." "He's in jail?" Westlake asked, chewing on a thumbnail. "Yes, sir. That's all I can get as of now. Don't know when he might be getting out. I'm trying to get the police to check hotel records to find Baldwin, but they're hesitant to do so. He's not a fugitive. They don't like to piss off the hotels. It was the weekend, etc. Find Baldwin." "Trying, sir." "What's he up to?" Fox shook his head. "It makes no sense. Why burn that much cash on a private jet? Why travel with someone using a fake passport? Who the hell is Nathaniel Coley? We've done a search in Virginia and West Virginia and found no possible hits. Maybe Coley is a good friend who can't get a passport and they were trying to beat customs so they can play in the sun for a few days." "Maybe, maybe." "You got it, sir. Keep digging and report back by email." "Yes, sir. I'm assuming he left his car behind at the Roanoke Airport." "He did. In the parking lot of the General Aviation Terminal. Same Florida license plates. We found it Saturday morning and have it under surveillance."
"Good. Just find him, okay?"
"And if we do?"
"Just follow him and figure out what he's doing."
Over coffee and gold, we plan our day, but we do not linger. At 9, Vanessa turns in the key at the front desk and checks out. We kiss goodbye, and I follow her out of the parking lot, careful not to crowd the rear bumper of her Accord. On the other side of it, hidden deep in the trunk, is half the gold. The other half is in the trunk of my rented Impala. We separate at the interchange. She's going north, and I'm going south. She waves in the rearview mirror, and I wonder when I'll see her again. As I settle into the long drive, tall coffee in hand, I remind myself that the time must be spent wisely. No foolish daydreaming. No mental loafing. No fantasies about what to do with all the money. So many issues vie for priority. When will the police find Nathan's truck? When do I call Rashford Watley and instruct him to pass along the message to Nathan that things are proceeding as planned? How many of these cigar boxes will fit into the bank lockboxes I leased a month ago? How much of the gold should I try to sell at a discount to raise cash? How do I get the attention of Victor Westlake and Stanley Mumphrey, the U.S. attorney in Roanoke? And most important, how do we get the gold out of the country, and how long might it take? Instead, my mind drifts to thoughts of my father, old Henry, who hasn't had contact with his younger son in over 4 months. I'm sure he's disgusted with me for getting busted out of Frostburg and shipped off to Fort Wayne. I'm sure he's puzzled by the absence of correspondence. He's probably calling my brother Marcus in D.C. and my sister Ruby in California to see if they've heard anything. I wonder if Henry's a great-grandfather yet, courtesy of Marcus's delinquent son and his 14-year-old girlfriend. Or did she get the abortion? On second thought, maybe I don't miss my family as much as I sometimes think. It would be nice, though, to see my father, though I suspect he will not approve of my altered looks. Truth is, there's a good chance I'll never see any of them again. Depending on the whims and machinations of the federal government, I could remain a free man, or I could spend the rest of my life as a fugitive. Regardless, I'll have the gold. As the miles pass and I cling to the speed limit while trying to avoid getting hit by the big rigs,
I can't help but think of Bo. I've been out of prison for 4 months now, and every day I've fought the urge to dwell on my son. It's too painful to think I may never see him again. But as the weeks go by, I have come to accept this reality. Reuniting with him in some fashion would be the first huge step down the road to normalcy. But my life from now on will be anything but normal. We could never again live together under the same roof as father and son. And I see no benefit to Bo of knowing that I'm suddenly around and would like to have an ice cream twice a month. I'm sure he still remembers me, but the memories are certainly fading. Dionne is a smart, lovely woman, and I'm sure she and her second husband are providing a happy life for Bo. Why should I, a virtual stranger and a guy who certainly looks like one, pop into their world and upset things? Once I convinced Bo I was really his father, how would I rekindle a relationship that's been dead for over 5 years? To stop this torment, I try to focus on the next few hours, then the next few days. Crucial steps lie ahead, and a screw-up could cost me a fortune and possibly send me back to prison. I stop for gas and a vending machine sandwich near Savannah, and 2.5 hours later, I'm in Neptune Beach, my old temporary stomping ground. At an office supply store, I purchase a heavy, thick briefcase, then drive to a public parking area for the beach. There are no security cameras and no foot traffic, and I quickly open the trunk, remove 2 of the cigar boxes, and place them in the briefcase. It weighs about 40 pounds, and as I walk around the car, I realize it's too heavy. I remove 1 container and return it to the trunk. 4 blocks away, I park at First Coast Trust and nonchalantly walk toward the front door. The digital thermometer on the bank's rotating billboard reads 96 degrees. The briefcase gets heavier with each step, and I struggle to act as though it contains nothing but some important papers. 20 pounds is not a lot of weight, but it's far too much for a briefcase of any size. Every step is now being captured on video, and the last thing I want is the image of me lumbering into the bank with a heavy satchel. I worry about Vanessa and her efforts to access her lockboxes in Richmond with such a burden on her shoulder. Heavy as it is, I can't help but smile at the astonishing weight of pure gold. Inside, I wait patiently for the vault clerk to finish with another customer. When it's my turn, I give her my Florida driver's license and sign my name. She checks my face and my handwriting, approves, and escorts me to the vault in the rear of the bank. She inserts the house key into my lockbox, and I insert my own. Noises click perfectly, the box is released, and I carry it to a narrow private closet and close the door. The clerk waits outside, in the center of the vault. The lockbox is 6 inches wide, 6 inches tall, and 18 inches long, the largest available when I leased it a month ago for 1 year at $300 per. I place the cigar box inside. Vanessa and I labeled each one with the exact number of mini bars. This one has 33, or 330 ounces. Roughly $500,000. I close the box, admire it, kill a few minutes, then open the door and report to the clerk. Part of her job is to remain aloof with no suspicions whatsoever, and she does it well. I suppose she's seen it all. 20 minutes later, I'm in the vault at a branch of the Jacksonville Savings Bank. The vault is larger, the lockbox is smaller, the clerk more suspicious, but everything else is the same. Behind a locked door, I gently place another stash of mini bars into the box. 32 gorgeous little ingots worth another $500,000. At my third and final bank, not a half mile from the first one, I make the last deposit of the day.
then spend an hour looking for a motel where I can park just outside my room. In a mall on the west end of Richmond, Vanessa wanders through a high-end department store until she finds the ladies' accessories. Though she acts calm, she is all nerves because a record is alone out there in the parking lot, just waiting to be vandalized or stolen. She selects a chic red leather shoulder bag large enough to be called luggage. Its designer is well known, and it will probably be noticed by the female clerks who run the banks. She pays cash for it and hustles back to her car. 2 weeks earlier, Max, she had always known him as Malcolm, but she liked the new name better, had instructed her to rent 3 lockboxes. She had carefully selected the banks around Richmond, made the applications, passed the screenings, and paid the fees. Then, as instructed, she had visited each one twice to deposit useless paperwork and such. The vault clerks now recognized her, trusted her, and were not the least bit suspicious when Ms. Vanessa Young showed up with a killer new bag and needed access to the vault. In less than 90 minutes, Vanessa safely stashes away almost $1.5 million in gold bullion. She returns to her apartment for the first time in over a week and parks in a space she can see from her second floor window. The complex is in a nice part of town, near the University of Richmond, and the neighborhood is generally safe. She has lived here for 2 years and cannot remember a stolen car or a burglary. Nevertheless, she is taking no chances. She inspects the doors and windows for signs of entry and finds none. She showers, changes clothes, then leaves. 4 hours later, she returns, and in the darkness, she slowly, methodically hauls the treasure into her apartment and hides it under her bed. She sleeps above it, the Glock on the night table, every door locked and latched, and jammed with a chair. She drifts in and out, and at dawn, she's sipping coffee on the sofa in the den, watching the weather on local cable. The clock seems to have stopped. She would love to sleep some more, but her mind will not allow her body to surrender. Her appetite is gone too, though she tries to choke down some cottage cheese. Every 10 minutes or so, she walks to the window and checks the parking lot. The early morning commuters leave in shifts. 7:30, 7:45, 8 o'clock. The banks do not open until 9. She takes a long shower, dresses as if she's going to court, packs a bag, and takes it to her car. Over the next 20 minutes, she removes 3 of the cigar boxes from under the bed and takes them to her car. These she will soon deposit in the same 3 lockboxes she visited the day before. The great debate raging in her mind is whether the remaining 3 canisters will be safer in the trunk of her car or in her apartment under the bed. She decides to play it both ways and leaves 2 at home while taking another one with her. Vanessa calls with the news that she's made her 3rd and final deposit of the morning and is headed to Roanoke to see the lawyer. I'm ahead of her by a step or two. I visited my 3 banks a bit earlier, made the deposits, and am now driving to Miami. We have tucked away 380 of the 570 mini bars. It's a good feeling, but the pressure is still on. The feds can and will seize all assets under the right circumstances, and even the wrong ones, so we can take no chances. I have to get the gold out of the country. I am assuming the feds do not know Vanessa and I are working together. I am also assuming they have yet to link Nathan Cooley to me. I'm making lots of assumptions and have no way of knowing if they are correct. Chapter 39. Stalled in construction traffic near Fort Lauderdale, I punch in the numbers to Mr. Rashford Watley's cell phone down in Montego Bay.
He answers with a warm laugh, as if we've been friends for decades. I explain I'm safely back home in the U.S., and life is swell. 48 hours ago, I was sneaking out of Jamaica after saying goodbye to both Nathan and Rashford, terrified I would be stopped by uniformed men before boarding the flight to Puerto Rico. I am stunned at how fast things are happening. I repeatedly remind myself to stay focused and think about the next move. Rashford has not visited the jail since Sunday. I explain that Nathaniel has hatched a scheme to start bribing people down there and is having delusions about my returning with a boxload of cash. I've made a few calls, and it seems as if the boy has a long history with cocaine. Still can't believe the idiot would attempt to smuggle in 4 kilos. Can't begin to explain the gun. A moron. Rashford agrees and says he chatted with the prosecutor yesterday, Monday. If Rashford can work his magic, our boy is looking at about 20 years in the Jamaican prison system. Frankly, Rashford advises, he doesn't think Nathaniel will survive long in the system. Based on the beatings he's received his first 2 nights in jail, he'll be lucky to live a full week. We agree that Rashford will visit the jail this afternoon and check on Nathaniel. I ask him to pass along the message that I am hard at work securing his release. The visit to his home went as planned, and all things are proceeding as discussed. As you wish, Rashford says. I paid his fee, so he's still working for me, technically. I hope it's our last conversation. Vanessa once again makes the 3.5-hour drive from Richmond to Roanoke and arrives promptly for a 2 p.m. meeting with Dusty Shiver, attorney for Quinn Rucker. When she called to schedule the appointment, she promised to have in her possession crucial evidence about Quinn's case. Dusty was intrigued and attempted to pry over the phone, but she insisted on a meeting as soon as possible. She is dressed fashionably in a skirt short enough to get attention, and she carries a smart leather attaché. Dusty jumps to his feet when she enters his office and offers a chair. A secretary brings in coffee, and they manage some strained small talk until the door is closed for good.
I'll get right to the point, Mr. Shiver, she says. Quinn Rucker is my brother, and I can prove he's innocent.
Dusty absorbs this and allows it to rattle around the room. He knows Quinn has 2 brothers, D-Ray and Tall Man, and a sister, Lucinda. All have been active in the family business. He now remembers that there was another sister who has not been involved and has never been mentioned.
Quinn is your brother, he repeats, almost mumbling.
Yes, I left D.C. a few years ago and have kept my distance.
Okay, I'm listening. Let's hear it.
Vanessa recrosses her legs, and Dusty maintains eye contact. She begins.
A week or so after Quinn walked away from the camp at Frostburg, he almost overdosed on cocaine in D.C. We, the family, knew he would kill himself with the stuff. Quinn was always the heaviest user, and we intervened. My brother D-Ray and I drove him to a rehab facility near Akron, Ohio, a tough place for serious addicts. There was no court order, so they couldn't lock him down, but that's basically what happens at this facility. Quinn had been there for 21 days when the bodies of Judge Fawcett and his secretary were found on February 7th. She lifts a file from her briefcase and places it on Dusty's desk. The paperwork is all here. Because he had just escaped from prison, he was admitted under an assumed name, Mr. James Williams. We paid a deposit of $20,000 in cash, so the rehab facility was happy to go along. They didn't ask a lot of questions. They gave him a complete physical exam, complete blood work, So there's DNA proof that Quinn was there at the time of the murders. How long have you known this?
I cannot answer all of your questions, Mr. Shiver. There are many secrets in our family, and not many answers.
Dusty stares at her, and she coolly returns his look. He knows he will not learn everything, and at the moment, it's not that important. He has just won a major victory over the government, and he is already laughing.
Why did he confess?
Why does anyone confess to a crime they didn't commit?
I don't know. Quinn is severely bipolar and has other problems. The FBI hammered him for 10 hours and used all the dirty tricks at their disposal. Knowing Quinn, he was playing games. He probably gave them what they wanted so they would leave him alone. Maybe he fabricated a tall tale so they would run around in circles trying to verify it. I don't know. Remember the Lindbergh baby kidnapping? The most famous kidnapping in history?
I've read about it, sure.
Well, at least 150 people confessed to that crime. It makes no sense. But then Quinn can be crazy at times.
Dusty opens the file. There is a report of each day Quinn was in rehab, from January 17th through February 7th, the Monday they found the bodies of Judge Fawcett and Naomi Clary.
It says here he left the facility on the afternoon of February 7th, Dusty says, reading.
That's right. He walked away, or escaped, and made his way to Roanoke.
And why, might I ask, did he go to Roanoke?
Again, Mr. Shiver, I can't answer a lot of questions.
So he shows up in Roanoke the day after the bodies are found, goes to a bar, gets drunk, gets in a fight, gets arrested, and he's got a pocket full of cash.
There are a lot of gaps here, Miss...
Yes, there are. And with time, the gaps will be filled in. Right now, though, it's not that important, is it? What's important is that you have clear proof of his innocence. Other than the bogus confession, the government has no evidence against my brother, right?
That's correct. There's no physical evidence, just a lot of suspicious behavior, such as, why was he in Roanoke? How did he get there? Where did he get all that cash? Where did he buy the stolen guns? Lots of questions, miss. But I suppose you don't have the answers, right?
Correct.
Dusty locks his hands behind his head and stares at the ceiling. After a long, silent gap, he says,
I'll have to investigate this, you know. I'll have to go to the rehab center, interview the people there, take affidavits and such. The feds are not about to roll over until our file is much thicker and we can hit them over the head with it. I'll need another $25,000.
Without hesitation, she says, I'll discuss it with D-Ray.
The pretrial conference is in 2 weeks, so we need to move fast. I'd like to file a motion to dismiss the charges before the conference.
You're the lawyer. Another pause as Dusty leans forward on his elbows and looks at Vanessa.
I knew Judge Fawcett well. We weren't friends, but friendly acquaintances. If Quinn didn't kill him, any idea who did?
She is already shaking her head. No. The police found Nathan's truck at the general aviation area of the Roanoke Regional Airport late Tuesday morning. As expected, his employees at the bar became concerned Monday when he didn't show, and by late afternoon, they were making calls. They finally contacted the police, who eventually scoured the airport. Nathan had boasted of flying to Miami on a private jet, so the search was not difficult, at least for his truck. Finding it did not automatically indicate foul play, and the police were in no hurry to start a manhunt. A quick background check on the name revealed the criminal record,
and this did nothing to create sympathy. There was no family screaming for the lost loved one. A computer search and a few phone calls revealed that Nathan had purchased the brand new Chevy Silverado 2 months earlier from a dealer in Lexington, Virginia, an hour north of Roanoke on Interstate 81. The selling price was $41,000, and Nathan had paid in cash. Not the kind of cash often referred to when one writes a check, but hard cash, an impressive stack of $100 bills. Unknown to the car dealer, or the police, or anyone else for that matter, Nathan had found himself a gold trader. I finally find one myself. After two trips into the vault of the Palmetto Trust in South Central Miami, I still have in my possession, in the trunk of my rented Impala, exactly 41 of the precious little mini bars, value of about $600,000. I need to convert some of them to cash, and to do so, I am forced to enter the shady world of gold trading, where rules are pliant and adjusted on the fly, and all characters have shifty eyes and speak in double talk. The first two dealers, lifted from the yellow pages, suspect I'm an agent of some variety and promptly hang up. The third one, a gentleman with an accent, which I'm quickly learning is not unusual in the trade, wants to know how I came to possess a 10-ounce bar of seemingly pure gold. "It's a long story," I say, then hang up. Number four is a small fry who pawns appliances out front and buys jewelry in the back. Number five shows some potential, but, of course, we'll have to see what I've got. I explain that I do not want to walk into his store because I do not wish to be caught on video. He pauses, and I suspect he's thinking about getting robbed of his cash at gunpoint. We eventually agree to meet at an ice cream shop 2 doors down from his store, in a shopping center, in a good part of town. He'll be wearing a black Marlins cap. 30 minutes later, I'm sitting in front of a double pistachio gelato. Hassan, a large gray-bearded Syrian, is across from me and working on a triple chocolate fudge. 20 feet away is another swarthy gentleman who's reading a newspaper, eating frozen yogurt, and probably ready to shoot me if I show the slightest sign of causing trouble. After we try and fail at small talk, I slide over a crumpled envelope. Inside is a single gold bar. Hassan glances around, but the only customers are young moms and their 5-year-olds, along with the other Syrian. He takes the mini bar into his thick paw, squeezes it, smiles, taps it slightly on the corner of the table, and mumbles, "Wow." This he manages without the slightest hint of an accent. I am amazed at how soothing that simple expression is. I have never thought about the gold being fake, but to have it legitimized by a pro is suddenly refreshing. "You like, huh?" I say stupidly, just trying to get something out. "Very nice," he says, easing the bar into the envelope. I reach over and take it. He asks, "How many?" "Let's say 5 bars, 50 ounces. Gold closed yesterday at $1,520 an ounce, so I know the price of gold," he interrupts. "Of course you do. Do you want to buy 5 bars? A guy like this never says yes or no. Instead, he mumbles, talks in circles, hedges, and bluffs. He says, "It is possible, and it certainly depends on the price." "What can you offer?" I ask, but not too eagerly. There are other gold dealers left in the yellow pages, though I'm running out of time and weary of the cold calling. "Well, that depends, Mr. Baldwin, on several things. One must assume in a situation like this that the gold is of, shall we say, the black market variety.
I don't know where you got it, and don't want to know. But there is a reasonable chance it was, shall we say, extracted from its previous owner. Does it really matter where... Are you the registered owner of this gold, Mr. Baldwin? He asks sharply. I glance around. No. Of course not. Therefore, the black market discount is 20%. This guy doesn't need a calculator. I'll pay $1,220 an ounce. He says softly but firmly as he leans forward. His beard partially covers his lips, but his accented words are clear. For 5 bars? I ask. 50 ounces? Assuming the other 4 are of the same quality. They are identical. And you have no registration, records, paperwork, nothing. Correct, Mr. Baldwin? That's right. And I want no records now. A simple deal, gold for cash, no receipts, no paperwork, no videos, nothing. I came and went and vanished in the night. Hassan smiles and offers his right hand. We shake. The deal is done. And we agree to meet at 9 the following morning at a deli across the street, one with booths where we can do our counting in private. I leave the ice cream parlor as if I've committed a crime and repeat to myself what should be obvious. To wit, it is not against the law to buy and sell gold at discounted prices or at inflated ones. This is not crack we're peddling on the street, nor is it inside information from a boardroom. It's a perfectly legitimate transaction, right? Anyone watching Hassan and me would swear they were observing 2 crooks negotiating a crooked deal. Who could blame them? At this point, I am beyond caring. I'm taking risks, but I have no choice. Hassan is a risk, but I need the cash. Getting the gold out of the country will require risks, but leaving it here could mean losing it. I spend the next 2 hours shopping at discount stores. I buy random items such as backgammon sets, small toolboxes, hardback books, and 3 cheap laptop computers. I haul my goods into a ground-level motel room south of Coral Gables and spend the rest of the night tinkering, packing, and sipping cold beer. From the laptops, I remove the hard drives and the batteries, and managed to replace them with 3 of my little bricks. Inside each hardback, I stuff 1 mini bar wrapped in newspaper and aluminum foil, then bind it tightly with duct tape. In the toolboxes, I leave the hammer and screwdrivers, but remove everything else. 4 mini bars fit nicely into each one. The backgammon sets hold 2 bars without feeling suspicious. Using supplies from FedEx, UPS, and DHL, I carefully package my goods as the hours pass and I'm lost in another world. I call Vanessa twice and we replay our days. She's back in Richmond, doing the same thing I'm doing. We're both exhausted, physically and mentally, but we encourage each other to keep going. Now is not the time to slow down or get careless. At midnight, I finish and admire my handiwork. On the credenza, there are 12 overnight packages, all sealed and properly air-billed, efficient-looking, not the least bit suspicious, and together holding 32 mini-bars worth roughly $500,000. For international shipments, the paperwork is tedious, and I am forced to fudge on the contents. The sender is Mr. M. Reed Baldwin of Skelter Films in Miami, and the recipient is the same guy at Sugar Cove Villas, number 26, Willoughby Bay, Antigua. My plans are to be there to receive them. If they arrive at their destination without incident,
Vanessa and I will probably try similar shipments in the near future. If something goes wrong, we'll make new plans. Shipping like this is another risk. The packages might be searched and confiscated. The gold could be stolen somewhere along the way. However, I'm reasonably confident it will find its new home. I remind myself we're not shipping banned substances here. I'm too wired to sleep. And at 2 a.m., I turn on the lights and my laptop and fiddle with the email. It is to Mr. Stanley Mumphrey, U.S. Attorney, Southern District of Virginia, and Mr. Victor Westlake, FBI, Washington. The current draft reads, Dear Mr. Mumphrey and Mr. Westlake, I'm afraid I've made a grave mistake. Quinn Rucker did not kill Judge Raymond Fawcett and Ms. Naomi Clary. Now that I'm out of prison, it has taken me several months to realize this and to identify the real killer. Quinn's confession is bogus, as you probably know by now, and you have zero physical evidence against him. His attorney, Dusty Shiver, now has in his possession clear proof of an airtight alibi that will clear Quinn, so prepare yourselves for the reality of dropping all charges against him. Sorry for any inconvenience. It is imperative that we talk as soon as possible. I have a detailed plan of how to proceed, and only your total cooperation will lead to the apprehension and conviction of the killer. My plan begins with the promise of complete immunity for myself and others, and it ends with the precise result that you desire. Working together, we can finally resolve this matter and bring about justice. I am out of the country and have no plans to return, ever. Sincerely, Malcolm Bannister. Chapter 40. Typically, sleep is fleeting. In fact, it is so elusive and fitful, I'm not sure I slept at all. There was so much to do that I find myself drinking bad coffee and staring at the television long before the sun rises. Finally, I shower, dress, load the overnight packages into my car, and hit the empty streets of Miami in search of breakfast. At 9, Hassan rumbles into the deli with a brown paper sack, as though he's been to the grocer for a few items. We huddle in a booth, order coffee, and while we dodge the waitress, we do the counting. His job is far easier than mine. He caresses the 5 mini bars before dropping them into the inside pockets of his wrinkled blazer. I poke into the brown bag and struggle to count 122 stacks of $100 bills, 10 per stack.
It's all there, he says, watching out for the waitress. $122,000.
When I'm satisfied, I close the bag and try to enjoy the coffee. 20 minutes after he arrives, he leaves. I wait a while, then head for the door, nervously expecting a SWAT team to assault me as I hustle to my car. I keep $22,000 for the trip and stuff $50,000 into 2 remaining backgammon sets. At a FedEx shipping office, I wait in line with 5 overnight packages and watch intently as the customers in front of me go about their business. When it's my turn, the clerk examines the air bills and nonchalantly asks, "What's inside?"
"Household items. Some books. Nothing of real value. Nothing to insure,"
I respond, the words carefully rehearsed.
"I have a place on Antigua. Just sprucing it up a bit."
She nods as if she's really interested in my plans. For standard business delivery, 3 days guaranteed, the bill comes to $310, and I pay with a prepaid credit card. As I leave the lobby and leave the gold behind, I take a deep breath and hope for the best. Using the rental car's GPS, I locate a UPS office and go through the same procedure. I return to Palmetto Trust, and it takes an hour to get into my lockbox. I leave behind the rest of the cash and the four remaining minibars. It takes a while to find the DHL shipping desk in the sprawl of Miami International, but I eventually negotiate my way there and drop off more packages. I finally part with my Impala at an Avis station and take a cab to the general aviation section of the airport, far away from the main terminal. There are blocks of private aircraft hangars and charter companies and flight schools, and my driver gets lost as we search in vain for an outfit called Maritime Aviation. It needs a larger sign because the one currently in use can hardly be seen from the nearest street, and I'm tempted to bark this at the clerk when I walk in the door. I manage to bite my tongue and relax. There is no scanner to examine me or my luggage, and I assume private aircraft terminals are not equipped with these machines. I expect to be scanned at some level upon my arrival in Antigua, so I'm playing it safe. I have about $30,000 in cash, with most of it hidden in my luggage. And if they dig through it and get excited, I'll play dumb and pay the fine. I was tempted to try to smuggle in a gold bar or two to see if it can be done, but the risk is greater than the reward. At 1:30, the pilots say it's time to board, and we crawl inside a Learjet 35, a small jet, about half the size of the Challenger Nathan and I enjoyed briefly during our recent trip to Jamaica. The 35 can perhaps seat six people, but full-sized men would be shoulder to shoulder. Instead of a restroom, there is an emergency potty under a seat. It's cramped, to say the least, but who cares? It's far cheaper than a big plane, but just as fast. I'm the only passenger, and I'm in a hurry. Max Baldwin on board here, with proper documentation. Malcolm Bannister has been retired for the final time. I'm sure customs will eventually notify some spook within the FBI, and after some puzzlement, he'll report to his boss. They'll rub their chins and wonder what Baldwin is doing, what's his thing with private jets, why is he spending all his money? A lot of questions, but the big one is still, what the hell is he doing? They will have no clue unless I tell them. As we taxi away from the terminal, I quickly review the email to Mumphrey and Westlake. Then I press send. It is July 28th. 4 months ago, I left Frostburg, and 2 months ago, I left Fort Carson with a new face and name. As I try to recall these past few weeks and put them into perspective, I begin to nod off. When we reach our altitude of 40,000 feet, I fall asleep. 2 hours later, I am awakened by turbulence and look through the window. We are streaking over a summer thunderstorm, and the small jet is getting bounced around. One of the pilots turns around and gives me a thumbs up. Everything's okay. If you say so, pal. Minutes later, the sky is calm again. The storm is behind us, and I gaze down at the beautiful waters of the Caribbean. According to the nav screen on the bulkhead in front of me, we are about to pass over St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. There are so many beautiful islands down there, and so much variety. When I was in prison, I kept hidden in the library a Photo's Guide to the Caribbean, a thick reference book with 2 dozen color photos, maps, lists of things to do, and brief histories of all the islands. I dreamed that I would one day be loose in the Caribbean, alone with Vanessa, just the two of us on a small sailboat, drifting from island to island in complete and unrestrained freedom. I do not know how to sail, and I've never owned a boat. But that was Malcolm. Today, Max is starting a new life at 43, and if he wants to buy a skiff, learn to sail, and spend the rest of his life drifting from beach to beach, who can stop him? The plane jolts slightly as the engines cut back a notch. I watch the captain ease down on the throttles as we begin a long descent. There's a small cooler by the door, and I find a beer, We pass over Nevis and St. Kitts in the distance. Those two islands have attractive banking laws, too, and I considered them briefly, back when I was at Frostburg and had plenty of time to dwell on my research. I considered the Cayman Islands, but learned that they are now terribly overbuilt. The Bahamas are too close to Florida and filthy with U.S. agents. Puerto Rico is a territory, so it never made any of my lists. St. Bart's has traffic jams. The U.S. Virgins have too much crime. Jamaica is where Nathan now resides. I chose Antigua as my first base of operations because there are 75,000 people, almost all black like me. Not overcrowded, but not sparsely populated either. It's a mountainous island with 365 beaches, one for each day. Or so say the brochures and websites. I chose Antigua because its banks are notoriously flexible and known to look the other way. And if for some reason the island displeases me, I'll be quick to move along. There are too many other places to see. We slam onto the runway and screech to a halt. The captain turns around and mouths the words, "Sorry about that." Pilots take great pride in their smooth landings, and this guy is probably embarrassed. As if I care. The only thing that matters right now is a safe exit from the plane and a smooth entry into the country. There are two other jets at the private terminal, and fortunately, a large one has just landed. At least 10 adult Americans in shorts and sandals are heading into the building to get processed. I stall long enough to fall in behind them. As the immigration and customs agents go through their routines, I realize there are no scanners for the private passengers and their bags. Excellent. I say goodbye to the pilots. Outside the small building, I watch the other Americans load into a waiting van and disappear. I sit on a bench until my cab appears. The villa is on Willoughby Bay, 20 minutes from the airport. I ride in the back of the cab, windows down, warm, salty air blowing in my face as we twist around one side of a mountain and slowly descend the other. In the distance, there are dozens of small boats moored in a bay, resting on blue water that seems perfectly still. It is a furnished two-bedroom condo in a cluster of the same, not directly facing the beach, but close enough to hear the waves break. It's leased in my current name, and the three-month rental was covered by a Skelter Films check. I pay the cab driver and walk through the front gate of Sugar Cove. A pleasant lady in the office gives me the key and a booklet on the ins and outs of the unit. I let myself in, turn on the fans and air conditioning, and check out the rooms. 15 minutes later, I'm in the ocean. At precisely 5:30 p.m., Stanley Mumphrey and two of his underlings gathered around a speaker in the center of a conference room table. Within seconds, the voice of Victor Westlake came on, and after quick hellos, Westlake said, "So, Stan, what do you make of it?" Stanley, who'd been thinking of nothing else since receiving the email 4 hours earlier, replied, "Well, Vic, it seems to me that we first need to decide whether we're going to believe this guy again, don't you think? I mean, he admits he got it wrong the last time. He doesn't admit to lying to us, but instead says he just made a mistake. He's playing games."
"It will be hard to trust him again," Westlake said.
"Do you know where he is right now?"
Mumphrey asked. "He just flew from Miami to Antigua on a private jet. Last Friday, he flew from Roanoke to Jamaica on a private jet, then re-entered the country Sunday as Malcolm Bannister."
"Any idea what he's doing with all these weird movements?"
"Not a clue, Stan. We're baffled. He's proven himself quite adept at disappearing and at moving money around."
"Right. I have a scenario, Vic. Suppose he lied to us about Quinn Rucker. Maybe Rucker is part of the scheme, and he played along so Bannister could get himself out of prison. Now they're trying to save Rucker's ass.
Sounds like a conspiracy to me.
Lying. Conspiracy.
What if we pop them with a sealed indictment, scoop up Bannister and throw him back in jail, then see how much he knows about the real killer? He might be more talkative from the other side of the bars.
So you believe him now? Westlake asked.
Didn't say that, Vic, not at all. But if his email is true, and if Dusty Shiver has an alibi, then we're screwed with this prosecution.
Should we talk to Dusty?
We won't have to. If he's got the evidence, we'll see it soon enough. One thing I can't figure out, one of many, is why they sat on the evidence for so long.
Same here, Westlake said. One theory we're floating is that Bannister needed the time to find the killer, if, of course, we are to believe him. Frankly, I don't know what to believe at this point. What if Bannister knows the truth? We have nothing on our end. We don't have a shred of physical evidence. The confession is shaky. And if Dusty has a smoking gun, then we're all about to eat a bullet.
Mumphrey said, Let's indict them and squeeze them. I'll call in the grand jury tomorrow, and we'll have an indictment within 24 hours. How much trouble will it be grabbing Bannister in Antigua?
A pain in the ass. He'll have to be extradited. Could take months. Plus, he might vanish again. This guy is good. Let me talk to the boss before you call in the grand jury.
Okay. But if Bannister wants immunity, then it sounds as though he's committed a crime and wants a deal, right?
Westlake paused a second, then said, It's pretty rare for an innocent man to ask for immunity. It happens, but not very often. What crime are you thinking about?
Nothing definite, but we'll find one. Racketeering comes to mind. I'm sure we can bend RICO to fit these facts. Conspiracy to impede the judicial process. Lying to the court and the FBI. Come to think of it, the indictment is growing the longer we talk. I'm getting pissed, Vic. Bannister and Rucker were pals at Frostburg and cooked up this scheme. Rucker walked away in December. Judge Fawcett was killed in February. And now it looks like Bannister fed us a bunch of crap about Rucker and his motives. Don't know about you, Vic, but I'm beginning to feel as though we've been duped.
Let's not overreact here. The first step is to determine if Bannister is telling the truth.
Okay. And how do we go about doing that?
Let's wait on Dusty and see what he has. In the meantime, I'll talk to my boss. Let's chat again tomorrow.
You got it.
Chapter 41. At a tobacco store in downtown St. John's, I see something that freezes me, then makes me smile. It's a box of Lavos, an obscure cigar hand-wrapped in Honduras and costing twice as much in the States. The 4-inch torpedo model sells for $5 in Antigua and $10 at the downtown Roanoke tobacco store called Vandy's Smokes. It was there that Judge Fawcett routinely purchased his favorite brand. On the bottom side of four of the 14 Lavo boxes we now have stashed in banks, there are white square stickers advertising Vandy's, with phone number and street address. I buy 20 of the Lavo torpedoes and admire the box. It's made of wood, not cardboard, and the name appears to have been hand-carved across the top. Judge Fawcett was known to drift around Lake Higgins in his canoe, puffing on Lavos while fishing and enjoying the solitude. Evidently, he saved the empty boxes. The cruise ships have not arrived yet, so downtown is quiet. Merchants sit in the shade outside their shops, chatting and laughing in their seductive, lilting version of the King's English. I drift from shop to shop, oblivious to time. I have gone from the stultifying tedium of prison life to the jolting madness of tracking a killer and his loot, to this, the languid pace of island living. I prefer the latter, for obvious reasons, but also because it is now the present and the future.
Max is a new person with a new life, and the baggage is quickly falling by the wayside. I buy some clothes, shorts and t-shirts, beach stuff, then wander into my bank, the Royal Bank of the East Caribbean, and flirt with the cute girl working the front desk. She directs me on down the line, and I eventually present myself to the vault clerk. She studies my passport, then leads me into the depths of the bank. During my first visit 9 weeks ago, I rented two of the largest lockboxes available. Alone with them now, I leave some cash and worthless papers, and I wonder how long it will be before they are filled with little gold bars. I flirt on the way out and promise to be back soon. I rent a convertible Beetle for a month, put the top down, fire up a Lavo, and begin a tour of the island. After a few minutes, I feel dizzy. I can't recall the last time I smoked a cigar, and I'm not sure why I'm doing so now. The Lavo is short and black, and even looks strong. I toss it out the window and keep driving. FedEx wins the race. The first packages arrive Monday around noon, and because I have been anxiously roaming the grounds of Sugar Cove, I see the truck when it pulls up. Miss Robinson, the pleasant lady who runs the office, has by now heard the full version of the fiction. I am a writer, filmmaker, holed up in her villas for the next 3 months, working desperately to finish a novel and a screenplay based on said novel. My partners, meanwhile, are already filming preliminary scenes. Blah, blah, blah. Therefore, I am expecting approximately 20 overnight packages from Miami. Manuscripts, research memos, videos, even some equipment. She is visibly impressed. I'm really looking forward to the day when I can stop lying. Inside my villa, I open the boxes. A backgammon set yields 2 bars. A toolbox, 4. A hardback novel, 1. And another backgammon set, 2. A total of 9. All apparently untouched during their journey from Miami to Antigua. I often wonder about their history. Who mined the gold? From which continent? Who minted it? How did it get into this country? And so on. But I know these questions will never be answered. I hustle into St. John's, to the Royal Bank of the East Caribbean, and put the precious ingots to rest. My second email to Messrs. Westlake and Mumphrey reads, "Hey guys, it's me again. Shame on you for not responding to my email of 2 days ago. If you want to find Judge Fawcett's killer, then you need to work on your communication skills. I'm not going away. I'll bet your initial reaction is to trump up some bogus indictment and come after me and Quinn Rucker. You can't help this because you are, after all, the feds, and it's just your nature. What is it about our prosecutorial system that makes guys like you want to put everyone in jail? It's pathetic, really. I met dozens of good people in prison, men who wouldn't physically harm anyone, and men who would never screw up again, yet, thanks to you, they're serving long sentences and their lives are ruined. But I digress. Forget another indictment. You can't make the charges stick. Not that that has ever slowed you down.